Welcome to this week's Ortho Digest Weekly Rundown for the week of March 30th, 2026. We're covering 30 studies across arthroplasty, shoulder elbow, sports, foot ankle, pediatrics, spine, hand, basic science, trauma, and oncology. Let's start with our first study. Nishiura and colleagues published in Archives of Orthopedic and Trauma Surgery titled Prevalence and Risk Factors for Stem Subsidence Following Reverse Shoulder Arthroplasty Using Onlay Press Fit Short Stems. This retrospective cohort of 151 patients with minimum 2 years of follow-up evaluated stem subsidence, defined as 5 millimeters or greater displacement on serial AP radiographs. In reverse shoulder arthroplasty with onlay press fit short stems between 2017 and 2023. The work extends prior research on cementless short stem fixation in anatomic total shoulder arthroplasty and reverse shoulder arthroplasty. One limitation, subsidence didn't correlate with clinical outcome deterioration, raising questions about whether the 5 millimeter threshold is clinically meaningful. Consider monitoring metaphyseal filling ratio and bone quality when selecting press fit short stems, as subsidence occurred in 13.2% of cases, with metaphyseal filling ratio less than 70%, odds ratio 0.90, and osteoporosis odds ratio 3.2 as independent predictors. Next up, Raja and colleagues published in JSES, titled Custom Distal Humeral Replacement with Locked Flange in Revision Total Elbow Arthroplasty. This single institution registry study of 11 revision elbow arthroplasty patients with mean 32 months of follow-up, ranging from 6 to 93 months, evaluated a novel, custom, uncemented distal humeral replacement with locked flange in patients with significant distal humeral bone loss from aseptic loosening, infection, failed fixation, or periprosthetic fracture. These patients had undergone a mean of 6 prior procedures. The work extends prior reports on allograft prosthetic composites and megaprosthesis for distal humeral bone loss in tumor settings by demonstrating applicability in non-oncologic revision cases. One limitation, the heterogeneous indications, variable follow-up, and lack of a control group make it impossible to isolate implant-specific outcomes or compare against alternatives. Custom uncemented distal humeral megaprosthesis with locked flange achieved functional improvement and an 18% reoperation rate at mean 32 months in 11 revision elbow arthroplasty patients with severe bone loss. Moving on. Io and colleagues published in the American Journal of Sports Medicine, titled Deltoid Osteomuscular Transfer Suppresses Humeral Head Translation Caused by Massive Irreparable Rotator Cuff Tears, a cadaveric biomechanical study. This cadaveric study of 8 shoulders evaluated a novel deltoid osteomuscular transfer, a modification of the deltoid flap using bone from the distal clavicle, lateral acromion, or acromial angle fixed to the superior glenoid to address superior humeral head migration in massive irreparable rotator cuff tears. The work extends prior deltoid flap transfer literature by demonstrating that bone block fixation provides biomechanically superior humeral head depression compared to soft tissue-only techniques, potentially addressing the primary failure mechanism of the original procedure. One limitation, 8 specimens is critically underpowered, and the absence of cyclic loading means graft durability under physiologic stress is entirely unknown. Anterior harvest deltoid osteomuscular transfer from the distal clavicle significantly suppressed humeral head superior translation versus massive irreparable rotator cuff tear alone at 0 and 30 degrees of glenohumeral elevation across all applied force conditions from 0 to 30 newtons. Next, Teixeira and colleagues published in Injury, titled Are Peroneal Tendons Safe After Intramedullary Fibular Nailing? A prospective MRI-based cohort. This prospective cohort of 102 patients plus 10 healthy controls with MRI at 3 and 8 months postoperatively asked whether intramedullary fibular nailing causes iatrogenic peroneal tendon injury in patients with Weber B or C ankle fractures. The work extends the biomechanical and cadaveric literature on intramedullary fibular nailing portal safety. One limitation. The control group of 10 healthy volunteers is too small to robustly define normative tendon dimensions. Serial MRI at 3 and 8 months post-intramedullary fibular nailing showed peroneal tendon thickness equivalent to healthy controls, brevis 2.9 versus 2.8 millimeters, longus 3.4 versus 3.4 millimeters, with 0 MRI detectable pathology across 102 patients. Moving on, Elnagar and colleagues published an injury titled Open Reduction and Internal Fixation is Associated with Lower Early Morbidity but Greater Long-Term Revision Risk Compared with Acute Total Hip Arthroplasty for Acetabular Fractures in the Elderly. This retrospective cohort using the TriNetX database from 2005 to 2025 compared open reduction and internal fixation versus acute total hip arthroplasty in 4,052 propensity-matched patients aged 65 and older with acetabular fractures, 2,026 per group, with up to 15 years of follow-up and primary outcome at 2 years. The work extends the standard of care framework for geriatric acetabular fractures by quantifying that conversion total hip arthroplasty achieves equivalent long-term revision and mortality outcomes to acute total hip arthroplasty, providing the first large-scale propensity-matched evidence supporting conversion total hip arthroplasty as a planned salvage strategy. One limitation: absence of fracture classification data means the most critical determinant of surgical strategy is uncontrolled. In propensity-matched elderly patients with acetabular fractures, open reduction and internal fixation carries a 69% higher relative risk of revision arthroplasty at 2 years compared to acute total hip arthroplasty, 10.4% versus 6.1%. But acute total hip arthroplasty has significantly higher early infection, 7.1% versus 5%, and dislocation, 5.7% versus 4.3% rates. Moving on. Menendez and colleagues published in JSES titled, "Is Robotic-Assisted Reverse Shoulder Arthroplasty Economically Justified? A Break-Even Analysis." This break-even analysis asked whether the incremental cost of robotic assistance at $1,500 per case in reverse total shoulder arthroplasty is economically justified by reduction in early revision surgery at $22,920 per event, given a baseline one-year revision rate of 2.1%. The work extends prior revision and complication benchmarks for reverse total shoulder arthroplasty by quantifying the economic threshold that robotic assistance must clear, demonstrating that even optimistic revision rate assumptions cannot satisfy break-even criteria under current pricing. One limitation: the model evaluates only early revision as the economic endpoint, entirely excluding potential value on long-term implant survivorship and patient-reported outcomes. Robotic-assisted reverse total shoulder arthroplasty requires an absolute risk reduction in early revision of 6.55%, one revision prevented per 15 cases, to break even, which exceeds the observed baseline early revision rate of 2.1%, making routine economic justification impossible under current conditions. Moving on, Joe and colleagues published in Arthroscopy, titled "Double Bridges Technique of Lower Trapezius Plus Long Head of Biceps Tendon Transfer for Superior Capsular Reconstruction in Massive Rotator Cuff Tears Can Improve the External Rotation." This retrospective cohort compared long head of biceps tendon-based superior capsular reconstruction with versus without arthroscopy-assisted lower trapezius transfer in 116 enrolled patients with posterosuperior irreparable massive rotator cuff tears and Goutelier stage 3 or greater fatty infiltration. After propensity score matching on 7 variables, 72 patients remained, 36 per group, with mean 34.6 months follow-up in the lower trapezius transfer group and 39.8 months in the superior capsular reconstruction-only group, with minimum 2 years overall. The work extends prior literature by demonstrating that bone block fixation of the transfer deltoid to the superior glenoid provides biomechanically superior outcomes. One limitation: the infraspinatus re-tear outcome is based on only 12 total re-tear events across 72 patients, making the confidence interval extremely wide and the estimate statistically fragile. Adding lower trapezius transfer to long head of biceps tendon-based superior capsular reconstruction improves postoperative external rotation by 14.7 degrees, 35.3 degrees versus 20.6 degrees, p less than 0.001, and reduces infraspinatus re-tear rate from 27.8% to 5.6%, odds ratio 0.11, in massive posterosuperior irreparable rotator cuff tears with Goutelier 3 or greater fatty infiltration. Next, Koh and colleagues published in the Journal of Arthroplasty, titled "Dual Mobility versus Conventional Total Hip Arthroplasty for Femoral Neck Fractures, a Multicenter Propensity Match Study on Dislocation Risk." This multicenter retrospective propensity match study compared dislocation and revision incidence between dual mobility and conventional total hip arthroplasty in 822 displaced femoral neck fracture patients across four hospitals from 2012 to 2020. After propensity matching, 627 patients remained, 209 dual mobility versus 418 conventional, with up to 5 years of follow-up. The work extends prior dual mobility follow-up data confirming the long-term dislocation protection of dual mobility constructs by providing propensity-matched comparative evidence, specifically in the femoral neck fracture population. One limitation: the absence of functional outcome scores means the dislocation benefit cannot be contextualized against patient-reported quality of life differences. Dual mobility total hip arthroplasty reduced 5-year dislocation incidence from 4.8% to 0.5% compared to conventional total hip arthroplasty in femoral neck fracture patients without increasing overall revision rates. Moving on, DeMillionaire and colleagues published in Archives of Orthopedic and Trauma Surgery, titled "Concurrent Validation of a Novel Intraoperative Navigation Platform for Total Knee Arthroplasty," This cadaveric validation study of 7 fresh frozen cadaveric legs assessed whether the next AR augmented reality navigation platform could accurately reproduce planned implant alignment and provide reliable real-time kinematic and ligament elongation data during mechanical alignment total knee arthroplasty. The work extends prior navigation accuracy studies by adding concurrent kinematic and collateral ligament elongation data within the same intraoperative platform. One limitation: 7 cadaveric specimens is insufficient to characterize error distribution across the range of deformity and soft tissue conditions encountered clinically. The NextAR intraoperative navigation platform achieved implant alignment within a mean bias of 1.5 degrees or less of target across all 6 alignment parameters in cadaveric medially stabilized total knee arthroplasty with root mean square error of 2.3 degrees or less. Moving on. Gill and colleagues published in International Orthopedics titled Quality of Life Before and During the COVID-19 Pandemic for People Undergoing Hip, Knee, and Shoulder Arthroplasty. Nationwide results from the Australian Orthopedic Association National Joint Replacement Registry. This database study of more than 45,100 patients, more than 24,000 total hip arthroplasty, more than 20,000 total knee arthroplasty, and more than 1,100 reverse total shoulder arthroplasty, with 6 months post-operative follow-up, compared EQ-5D quality of life score, 5L utility scores, Oxford scores, pain and satisfaction before the pandemic, July 2018 to March 2020, and during the pandemic, March 2020 to March 2023. The work extends prior registry-based outcome research by applying patient-reported outcome measures to a pandemic-era natural experiment, demonstrating that the case mix shift toward higher acuity patients during elective surgery restrictions did not translate into clinically meaningful post-operative quality of life deterioration. One limitation: the registry only captures those who ultimately underwent surgery, missing patients who were indefinitely deferred. Despite statistically significant reductions in preoperative EQ-5D quality of life score 5L scores during COVID-19, the adjusted mean difference was 0.03 points or less, not clinically meaningful, while total hip arthroplasty and total knee arthroplasty patient satisfaction paradoxically increased by approximately 5 percentage points during the pandemic. Moving on, Imbote and colleagues published in the Journal of Bone and Joint Surgery, titled Outcomes and Complications of Vertebral Body Tethering in Skeletally Immature Patients with Idiopathic Scoliosis. This single-center prospective cohort of 74 skeletally immature patients with idiopathic scoliosis, mean preoperative Cobb angle 47.9 degrees with mean 63.4 months of follow-up, 5 to 8 years, evaluated radiographic outcomes and complications of vertebral body tethering. The work extends the standard of care framework for vertebral body tethering as a motion-preserving alternative to fusion in early onset and adolescent idiopathic scoliosis. The 66% tether breakage rate and 13.5% conversion to fusion rate at 5 or more years provide the longest prospective complication data to date. One limitation: single-center series with no control arm prevents direct comparison against posterior spinal fusion. At mean 63-month follow-up, vertebral body tethering achieved a final instrumented Cobb angle of 25.7 degrees from a preoperative mean of 47.9 degrees, but 66% had radiographic tether breakage and 21.6% required unplanned return to the operating room. Moving on, Emmett and colleagues published in the Journal of Children's Orthopedics titled Open Supracondylar Humerus Fractures in Children, Associated Injuries and Clinical Outcomes. This single-institution retrospective study evaluated the incidence, associated injuries, and outcomes of open pediatric supracondylar humerus fractures over a 20-year period, identifying 34 open fractures from 3,053 total supracondylar humerus fractures with pin removal at mean 4.7 plus or minus 1 week. The work extends the Gartland classification framework and standard lateral entry K-wire fixation algorithm by demonstrating that open supracondylar humerus fractures, uniformly Gartland 3 in this series, carry substantially higher complication burdens than the less than 5% neurovascular complication rates reported for closed Gartland 3 fractures, indicating that open status is an independent morbidity driver. One limitation: the 20-year study window spans significant evolution in surgical technique without stratification by era. Open supracondylar humerus fractures represent 1.1% of all pediatric supracondylar humerus fractures and carry a 20.6% nerve injury rate and 26.5% reoperation rate. Moving on, Tehan and colleagues published in Foot and Ankle International, titled Periprosthetic Joint Infection in Total Ankle Arthroplasty, an exploratory analysis of outcomes and challenges persisting in treatment. This single institution retrospective study identified 12 periprosthetic joint infection cases among 955 primary total ankle arthroplasty patients using MSIS criteria with median 5.7 years of follow-up, comparing outcomes between acute less than 4 weeks and chronic 4 weeks or greater infection. The work extends registry data reporting total ankle arthroplasty infection rates of 1 to 3% by characterizing organism-specific microbiological profiles and limb loss outcomes stratified by acuity, confirming that chronic periprosthetic joint infection carries disproportionately higher implant loss and amputation risk. One limitation, the 12-patient periprosthetic joint infection cohort is underpowered to support comparative treatment conclusions. Periprosthetic joint infection after total ankle arthroplasty occurred at 1.3%, 12 of 955 patients, 5.4 per 1,000 person years, with only 50% overall implant retention and 2 of 5 chronic periprosthetic joint infection patients ultimately requiring below-knee amputation. Moving on, Alcide and colleagues published in Spine, titled Impact of Operative Order on Postoperative Outcomes in Patients Undergoing Lumbar Fusion and Total Hip Arthroplasty, a Systematic Review and Meta-Analysis. This systematic review and meta-analysis of 22 studies and 161,326 patients with mean 2.6 years of follow-up asked whether performing lumbar fusion before total hip arthroplasty versus total hip arthroplasty before fusion affects postoperative complications and revision rates. The work extends prior literature by addressing the downstream clinical question of sequencing these two procedures. One limitation, the 88.4% prevalence of spine-then-hip sequencing, introduces profound selection bias, making the hip-then-spine group a non-representative minority. In 161,326 patients with concomitant lumbar fusion and total hip arthroplasty, operative order produced no significant difference in hip dislocation, mechanical loosening, periprosthetic fracture, deep vein thrombosis, infection, or revision rates, 3.6% versus 2.6%, p equals 0.50. Moving on, Lally and colleagues published in Spine, titled Patient-Specific Finite Element Modeling Outputs Outperform Clinical Metrics in Predicting Fusion Cage Subsidence. This biomechanical study of 42 patients asked whether preoperative CT-derived patient-specific finite element models outperform conventional clinical metrics in predicting severe cage subsidence, 4 millimeters or greater, after transforaminal lumbar interbody fusion. The work extends prior work on subsidence risk factors by demonstrating that integrated finite element stress strain outputs surpass individual clinical metrics in discriminative ability. One limitation, the cohort of 42 patients is underpowered to establish generalizable AUC cutoffs, and the near equal severe and non-severe split does not reflect the reported 20% clinical incidence of severe subsidence. Patient-specific CT-derived finite element models predict transforaminal lumbar interbody fusion cage subsidence with AUC 0.809, average trabecular intermediate strain, outperforming cage length AUC 0.797, cage width AUC 0.75, and cage height AUC 0.698. Moving on, Behrens and colleagues published in Foot and Ankle International, titled Multiplanar Interactions in the Cavivaris Foot. This case-control study of 73 participants using weight-bearing CT, 120 scans total, 40 Charcot-Marie-Tooth cavivaris, 40 idiopathic cavivaris, and 40 controls, compared multiplanar foot morphology across these groups. The work extends prior flat foot weight-bearing CT studies by demonstrating the inverse morphologic pattern in cavus, maximal transverse arch exaggeration between the plantar medial cuneiform and lateral metatarsals, contrasting directly with the collapse pattern in flat foot, and establishing Charcot-Marie-Tooth-specific quantitative weight-bearing CT benchmarks. One limitation, single-site design with only 40 subjects per group limits generalizability, and the absence of Charcot-Marie-Tooth subtype stratification precludes determining whether morphologic severity correlates with genotype. Charcot-Marie-Tooth cavivaris demonstrates forefoot adduction 3 times greater than controls and a significantly lower transverse arch plantar angle, 94.2 degrees, versus idiopathic cavus, 100.5 degrees, and controls, 102.7 degrees, confirming quantifiable multiplanar morphologic distinctions on weight-bearing CT. Moving on, Akshampong and colleagues published in the American Journal of Sports Medicine, titled Clinical Outcomes of Unipolar versus Bipolar Patellofemoral Fresh Osteochondral Allograft Transplantation. This retrospective cohort of 36 knees, 24 unipolar and 12 bipolar, from 35 patients with mean 3.58 years of follow-up compared graft failure, reoperation, and patient-reported outcomes between unipolar and bipolar patellofemoral osteochondral allograft transplantation at minimum 2-year follow-up. The work extends the tibiofemoral osteochondral allograft literature by examining the patellofemoral compartment specifically. One limitation, the bipolar cohort contained only 12 knees, making the 25% failure rate based on three events statistically fragile. Bipolar patellofemoral osteochondral allograft transplantation had a 25% structural graft failure rate versus 0% for unipolar, but cumulative lesion area, not bipolarity per se, was the independent predictor of failure, odds ratio 1.005 per square millimeter. Moving on, Halpern and colleagues published in the Journal of Pediatric Orthopedics, titled A Comparison of Continuous Epidural Spinal Opioid and Patient-Controlled Analgesia for Posterior Spinal Fusion for Adolescent Idiopathic Scoliosis, a multicenter international database study. This retrospective multicenter database study of 2,371 patients from 13 hospitals compared three postoperative analgesia strategies, continuous epidural, spinal opioid, and patient-controlled analgesia in adolescent idiopathic scoliosis patients aged 13 to 19 undergoing posterior spinal fusion. The work extends the broader posterior spinal fusion outcome literature by shifting focus to perioperative opioid stewardship, demonstrating that neuraxial techniques have opioid consumption without functional benefit over patient-controlled analgesia. One limitation, the retrospective, non-randomized design cannot exclude confounding by institutional protocol or surgeon preference. Spinal opioid and epidural analgesia reduce total opioid consumption by more than 50% compared to patient-controlled analgesia, 1.7 and 1.9 versus 4.1 oral morphine equivalents per kilogram, after posterior spinal fusion for adolescent idiopathic scoliosis without improving pain scores, complication rates, or length of stay. Moving on, Upstrom and colleagues published in the American Journal of Sports Medicine, titled Tibiofemoral Load Sharing and Lateral Meniscal Function Are Restored in Tibia and Capsular-Based Repair of Type 3 Lateral Meniscal Oblique Radial Tears. This cadaveric study of 8 knees tested whether type 3 lateral meniscal oblique radial tears, partial thickness, created 12 millimeters lateral to root attachment, alter lateral compartment mechanics, and whether repair construct choice matters, using 500 newtons axial load across 0, 30, 60, and 90 degrees flexion. The work challenges the standard ISACOS meniscal tear classification framework, which categorizes radial tears as generally non-repairable, by demonstrating that partial thickness oblique radial tears are biomechanically significant and that repair fully restores native mechanics. One limitation, sequential testing order was fixed, meaning debridement was always performed last, precluding independent assessment of its isolated effect. Both tibia-based suture anchor and capsular-based side-to-side repair of type 3 lateral meniscal oblique radial tears restored lateral compartment contact mechanics, meniscal extrusion, and anterior root forces to intact state values, while debridement failed to do so across all four flexion angles tested. Moving on, Legeri and colleagues published in Archives of Orthopedic and Trauma Surgery titled Lateral Unicompartmental Knee Arthroplasty Through a Medial Parapatellar Approach, Surgical Technique and Midterm Results in 108 Patients. This single-surgeon retrospective series of 108 patients with mean 47.6 months of follow-up, range 12 to 96.7 months, evaluated implant survivorship and functional outcomes of lateral unicompartmental knee arthroplasty performed through a medial parapatellar approach between 2016 and 2023. The work extends the established literature on lateral unicompartmental knee arthroplasty by demonstrating that a medial parapatellar approach yields survivorship and functional outcomes comparable to published lateral approach series. One limitation, absence of a concurrent lateral parapatellar approach control group makes it impossible to attribute outcomes to approach selection rather than surgeon experience. Lateral unicompartmental knee arthroplasty via medial parapatellar approach achieved 97.2% 7-year survivorship with 99.0% of patients meeting Knee Society score knee pass thresholds at mean 47.6 months in 108 patients. Moving on, Liu and colleagues published in the Journal of Bone and Joint Surgery, titled MRI Assessment of Median Nerve Size in Patients with Proximate Electrodiagnostic Studies. This retrospective cohort of 76 wrists from 68 patients evaluated whether MRI measured median nerve cross-sectional area at 3 wrist levels correlates with electrodiagnostic confirmed carpal tunnel syndrome diagnosis in patients who underwent both studies within 90 days. The work extends the ultrasound cross-sectional area literature by demonstrating that MRI-based cross-sectional area at the same anatomical level performs inferiorly, suggesting modality-specific thresholds cannot be assumed equivalent. One limitation, the retrospective design with only 76 wrists provides insufficient power to stratify diagnostic accuracy by electrodiagnostic severity grade. MRI measured median nerve cross-sectional area at the carpal tunnel inlet, cutoff 11.3 square millimeters, achieves only poor to fair diagnostic accuracy for carpal tunnel syndrome, AUC 0.67, sensitivity 74%, specificity 60%, limiting its utility as a standalone diagnostic tool. Moving on, Green and colleagues published in Spine titled Shifting Single-Level Anterior and Lateral Lumbar Interbody Fusion to the Ambulatory Setting, Comparative Outcomes from a Large Matched Cohort Analysis. This retrospective cohort of 16,684 patients, 8,342 matched pairs, compared complications, healthcare utilization, and cost between outpatient and inpatient single-level anterior lumbar interbody fusion and lateral lumbar interbody fusion using the Pearl Diver database from 2010 to 2022 with one-to-one matching on age, sex, and Ehlichhauser comorbidity index. The work extends the broader minimally invasive lumbar interbody fusion literature by demonstrating that the cost and safety advantages extend to the ambulatory setting specifically. One limitation: claims-based matching cannot fully account for the clinical selection bias inherent in choosing outpatient surgery. Outpatient single-level anterior lumbar interbody fusion and lateral lumbar interbody fusion demonstrated higher 5-year revision-free survival, log rank P less than 0.01, and 40% lower median 90-day global reimbursements, $5,169 versus $6,779 compared to matched inpatient controls. Moving on. Reddy and colleagues published in the Journal of Arthroplasty titled Patellofemoral Tracking Optimization in Robotic-Assisted Total Knee Arthroplasty. This retrospective cohort of 932 patients examined the effect of femoral component rotation on patellar tracking outcomes in robotic-assisted total knee arthroplasty, with outcomes collected at 6 weeks, 3 months, and 1 year postoperatively. The work extends prior literature by demonstrating that kinematic alignment strategies permitting femoral internal rotation carry implant-specific patellar tracking risks not captured by functional patient-reported outcome measures alone. One limitation: with only 3 patella-related complications, the study is critically underpowered to define a quantitative internal rotation threshold. All 3 patella-related complications, including 2 reoperations, in 932 robotic-assisted total knee arthroplasty cases occurred exclusively in the valgus internal rotation femoral component cohort, 15% of cases, despite no significant difference in knee injury and osteoarthritis outcome score JR or PROMIS scores at 1 year across alignment groups. Moving on, Lin and colleagues published in the Spine Journal titled A Nomogram Prediction Model for Lumbar Disc Herniation Recurrence After Percutaneous Endoscopic Lumbar Discectomy, a Multicenter Retrospective Study. This multicenter retrospective study of 3,610 patients, 2,436 training, 1,174 validation, developed and externally validated a nomogram to predict recurrent lumbar disc herniation after percutaneous endoscopic lumbar discectomy at L4, L5, or L5S1 using lasso-selected variables and multivariate logistic regression with recurrence defined by symptom return after minimum 2-week pain-free interval. The work extends the MODIC endplate change classification by quantifying MODIC type 2 as the dominant imaging predictor of recurrent lumbar disc herniation. One limitation: the absence of intraoperative variables, specifically annular defect size and extent of nucleus removal, omits factors with established mechanistic links to reherniation. A 6-variable nomogram predicts recurrent lumbar disc herniation after percutaneous endoscopic lumbar discectomy with AUC 0.755 training and 0.831 external validation, identifying MODIC type 2 changes, odds ratio 5.755, as the strongest independent predictor. Moving on, Fuqua and colleagues published in the Journal of Arthroplasty titled The Fate of the Patient Who Has Early Dislocation After Contemporary Primary Total Hip Arthroplasty. This database study of 420,053 primary total hip arthroplasty patients, 1,942 early dislocators versus 360,493 controls, used a national database from 2009 to 2022 to determine revision and redislocation rates after early total hip arthroplasty dislocation, with 2-year cumulative incidence from a 90-day landmark point. The work extends prior dislocation rate literature by quantifying the downstream revision burden after dislocation occurs, demonstrating that even in the contemporary high-stability bearing era, a single early dislocation confers a 22.6-fold increased all-cause revision hazard. One limitation: the database lacks component-level data, preventing identification of which modifiable technical factors drive the highest redislocation risk. Early dislocation within 90 days of primary total hip arthroplasty carries a 29.0% rate of recurrent dislocation or aseptic revision by 2 years versus 1.3% in controls, with hazard ratio 22.6 for all-cause revision. Moving on, Joshi and colleagues published in JSES titled Reassessing the Arthroplasty Landscape, Updated Incidence and Future Projections of Shoulder Arthroplasty Compared with Hip and Knee Arthroplasty in the United States. This database study of 704,930 procedures, 83,203 total shoulder arthroplasty, 267,683 total hip arthroplasty, and 354,044 total knee arthroplasty, examined trends in shoulder arthroplasty incidence and projected future volumes. The work extends prior epidemiologic analyses by providing updated incidence data and growth projections. One limitation: projection accuracy is highly model dependent, with the Poisson post-COVID estimate almost certainly reflecting pandemic rebound artifact rather than a sustainable growth trajectory. Total shoulder arthroplasty incidence grew 248% from 2015 to 2025, 13.1 to 45.6 per 100,000, and is projected to increase by 73 to 397% by 2040, representing the highest proportional annual growth rate of any major arthroplasty at 12.4% per year by Poisson modeling. Moving on, Ryu and colleagues published in Clinical Orthopedics and Related Research, titled Minimum 10-Year Results of Cementing a Polyethylene Liner into an Acetabular Cup with a Deficient Locking Mechanism. Is it a reliable option? This retrospective cohort of 51 patients with median 14 years of follow-up, range 10 to 18 years, evaluated durability, patient-reported outcomes, and survivorship after cementing a highly cross-linked polyethylene liner into well-fixed Harris Galante 2 shells with deficient locking mechanisms. The work extends prior case series reporting liner cementation as a viable salvage option. One limitation: single cup design limits generalizability to other acetabular shell geometries. Cementing a polyethylene liner into Harris Galante 2 shells yielded 77% survivorship free from acetabular cup revision at 15 years with a 39% overall complication rate. Moving on, Hopper and colleagues published in Arthroscopy, titled Quadriceps Tendon Autograft Produces Favorable Return to Sport, Strength, Range of Motion, Re-tear Rate, and Midterm Outcomes After Anterior Cruciate Ligament Reconstruction, a Systematic Review. This systematic review of 8 studies and 662 anterior cruciate ligament reconstructions with minimum 5-year follow-up evaluated midterm and long-term outcomes of quadriceps tendon autograft anterior cruciate ligament reconstruction, with follow-up ranging from 5 to 23 years across included studies. The work extends prior systematic reviews examining quadriceps tendon autograft at minimum 2-year follow-up by demonstrating that graft failure rates and range of motion deficits are higher at midterm follow-up, while anterior knee pain remains lower. One limitation: extreme heterogeneity across only 8 included studies with wide complication ranges prevents definitive quantitative conclusions. Quadriceps tendon autograft anterior cruciate ligament reconstruction demonstrates graft failure rates of 0 to 24% and anterior knee pain rates of 0 to 5% at 5 to 23 year follow-up across 662 reconstructions. Moving on, Shab and colleagues published in Arthroscopy, titled Iliopsoas Tunnel Deepening and Fractional Lengthening Relieve Painful Internal Snapping During Concomitant Primary Hip Arthroscopy for Treatment of Femoroacetabular Impingement, a PROP.